Almost everyone's going to do the home page. They're going to do some type of content page. So right now you have some flexibility. 3 weeks from now, you're going to need a much better idea of what you're going to want to test, because then we're going to be almost at the end of class. But save your time by thinking about that now. And this week we're going to focus on content. Okay, so quick show of hands. How many people have done wireframing? So it's about half the class who've done wireframing. Everyone knows what a wireframe is, right? How would you define it? What's a wireframe? What's it analogous to? What purpose does it solve?
Layout and sort of hierarchy, relative weights of the page.
Okay, so the page layout, the hierarchy of the content and functionality, the relative importance of the content and functionality on the page. What is a wireframe not? What isn't it doing?
It doesn't show branding or anything like that.
Generally speaking, it's not the visual design, it's not the brand. We'll often have just like the little placeholder image box, you know,
it's not
the kind
pretty.
Of thing that's like, put a photo here. Well, that's all an aesthetic decision. It's not pretty. Some people think wireframes are very pretty. But it's not the final visual design, right? It's not a mock-up of the site. It really is a structural diagram. It's a structural document. What's it analogous to? If you were to compare wireframes to something, what would you compare them to?
Blueprints.
Yeah, architectural blueprints, right? So if you work with an architect to build a house or a building, restaurant, whatever it happens to be, they spend a lot of time doing the floor plans. And you get these big blueprints, right? These big blue and white documents that show you the structure and where the plumbing goes and where the wiring goes. But they also have these documents that are called elevations. Has anyone with an architecture background or work with an what's an elevation?
Well, it shows like the slices, like.
Yeah, but it's a more detailed view, right? It's like, what's it gonna look like from outside? If you're standing at the street and you're looking at it, this is, say, the facade on the north side or something like that. So it's another level of detail, but it starts to get into the aesthetics a little bit. It's not just the structural document, it's about how it fits into the environment. Now, that gets us into a discussion about fidelity. Because a blueprint is low fidelity in terms of design. There's nothing in the blueprint that says what type of door handle is going to be there, or what type of faucet is going to be in the bathroom, or if it's a marble or granite or tile or wooden countertop in the kitchen. It just says, this is the kitchen, and there's a counter here, and the sink is there, and this is how the plumbing fits in, right? But an elevation now is like, this is what it looks like kind of from the outside, but it still has that sketchy style, and they put the little stylized trees and bushes in, and you see like the shape of the window and the door. So a certain level of detail sort of gets into it, but it's not necessarily a photographic quality or a painting of the final property, right? Some architects will do that. If you're building a really high-end house, they'll do a really nice elevation, you know, that makes it look like the house with the environment.
What about like 3D renderings? Where does that go?
Yet another level of fidelity, right? Where you can fly through the structure and see things rotated around from different angles. But the point is, there are levels of fidelity in blueprints. There are levels of fidelity in wireframes. We start off with lower levels of fidelity, but as we iterate the wireframes, we inevitably add more detail to it. And when we get to the point where we want to turn our wireframes into a prototype, we need a sufficient level of detail to set context, to have content for the people who are going to use the prototype. So it's almost like a prototype is like an elevation. It starts to resemble the final product, but we know it's not the final product. Looks a little bit like it, works a little bit like it, but it still feels a little unpolished. So the blueprint is like the wireframe, the elevation is like the prototype. The photograph of the final product, or the sketch that the colorist does to say, here's what we're going to do to the facade, that's more like the comp. Right? That's the visual design. That's where the branding is layered in, things like that. So fidelity is always an issue. And one of the questions that inevitably comes up when we talk about fidelity is, do I need to use real content in my wireframes? Has anyone gotten into that discussion or that argument with people? A few out there are nodding yes. So there are some people in the UX community who really argue very fervently that content in wireframes should always be real. That you should be designing for the content you know that is going to be there. And there are some really good reasons for why that's the case. If I don't know how much content is going to be there, I might create a wireframe that has two paragraphs of text. And that wireframe looks awesome and everything is balanced and I understand the hierarchy. And then months later, the client delivers content to the developer and we find out that that page doesn't have two paragraphs of content. It's got 500 paragraphs of content because they have a lot of information and we didn't know that. Or even if they got 10 paragraphs instead of two. But the point is, the page might not scale as effectively if we didn't know how much content was there. We designed a really good experience for two paragraphs of content, and 10 paragraphs of content may break it just enough. And then we get called back in to make design adjustments because we didn't know there was going to be 10 paragraphs of text, or we didn't know we were going to have to support pagination for large articles. So that's one of the arguments for get the real content. Get the imagery, get the text, if you can get the iconography, things like that, so that you understand how does it fit in, what does it look like, what's the style, what is the extent.
So what about internationalization, like German, translating to German? Like,
yeah, German is a great one, right? So anyone speak German? Okay, so we've got a few people who know German. German's awesome for localization because they've got the longest words on earth. And if anything is going to break in localization, it's going to be when you translate it into German. There are issues with the Asian ideographic languages as well, because most of our text, it looks fine at 12-point rendering, 16-pixel 12-point rendering. But when you go into the Asian languages with the ideograms, you need a minimum of 14-point or 18 to 20 pixels for them to render accurately. So they're bigger, but the nice thing is you get more words per symbol, so it balances out. But it has a height issue. German, on the other hand, you know, three letters in English becomes 27 in German, and so it wraps in weird ways. When we're localizing, we try to get translated samples to drop into the wireframes and into the comp so that we understand in advance how to scale the design. So we try to design for the scaling for languages. And it brings us sort of back around to the discussion of what do we do if the client doesn't have real content, right? So, from a project perspective, one of the single most challenging things you're going to encounter is convincing a client that they need to start creating their content right away. Because every client underestimates the time and effort necessary to generate content for their final site. 11 years later, I can tell you, every single client has underestimated the time and effort to generate the content for their site. And it's a really tough sell. You know, you got to start writing now. You got to start writing now. Because what they push back with is a very legitimate concern. How much space do I have? How many words do you need? What's the character count? How many images do I need? I have to pay for the photographer, so how many photos are going to go on this page? You're a content partner. Whether or not you realize it, as an information interaction designer, you are also part content strategist and part copywriter. You have to be able to have rational conversations with the client and to say, this is the page, this is the purpose of the page, how much information is going to be necessary for you to communicate clearly with the end user, with the visitor to the site? Do you think that you can communicate that in one paragraph, in one sentence, in three paragraphs? I can give you an idea from experience. I can say that on a page like this, it's usually a good solid paragraph, figure anywhere from 4 to 7 sentences. But I'm kind of lucky in that I've got experience and I can say that's what I think it's going to take. So we can put lorem ipsum placeholder in there and the client can write to the placeholder, this is how much space I have, but that almost always fails at some point, right? The client overwrites or underwrites, or they simply don't write anything at all. And so you're left with nonsense text as a placeholder, and you're not sure if it's right or the right amount, or even if that page is even necessary. So we're lucky in that our projects are redesign projects. Most of the content that we have to work with already exists. Now, in a real content strategy, we would review that. We'd say, you need to rewrite this, you need this new content, you need to pare this down. There's a general guideline also, it still holds true. When you're writing for the web, write what you want to say, then cut it in half, then cut it in half again. Okay? Because people overwrite for the web. People don't read as much on the web as they read in print form. So you have to write very concisely, very effectively, and that means doing it in a smaller number of words. So we can offer guidelines, we can offer suggestions, but if you can get the real content, then you know what you're designing for. I know I have 3 paragraphs and 6 photos, and I can create a wireframe that is optimized for that.
Well, I just want to kind of branch off a little bit, sorry. So what about like ontology for navigation with all these names, labels? When you do wireframes, you're going to have to put it in there. So yeah. Who's going to come up with that? And
99% of the time, you are.
Oh, man.
So one of the amazing things about your job as an information interaction designer is that you are going to make stuff up in order to have meaningful placeholders. We can't just put in nav1, nav2, nav3, nav4, because the client's going to look at that and go, which one is men's? Or which one is a description of the cave, right? Yeah. So when it comes to the really important text, things like button labels, nav labels, page headers, breadcrumbs, stuff like that that really sets the context of the page and generates a sense of place, it's often the onus is on us to generate a meaningful placeholder for that label. What very often happens is that we write stuff as a placeholder that the client then looks at as, oh, this is what it should say, and it gets adopted. And so very often our placeholder becomes real content in the final design or in the final content. So we need to be careful with our selection of placeholders. If you're generating placeholders that you think are meaningful and you want to make a recommendation to the client, be real about it, right? Use a word that you're not going to be embarrassed having show up in the final design. On the other hand, if you really don't know what the best word is going to be and you really want to force the client to generate the content, then use a placeholder term that you know the client would never go for in that spot, right? Buy shit here. They're gonna replace it, right? It's like, now I wouldn't really put that into it, it's an exaggeration. But you'll put label like, buy something, buy stuff, or buy my awesome product. You know they're not gonna keep that. So they're gonna think about what they wanted to say. On the other hand, the nav buttons, they often are trusting us on. You tell me what is a meaningful and predictive label for this nav. You're going to base it on the current site, you're going to base it on competitive analysis, you're going to base it on your familiarity with similar taxonomies. So there are lots of places where that's going to come from. But by default, you're going to do some content generation. What we need to do when we create the wireframes is balance, right? How much nonsensical placeholder stuff, the gray boxes with an X in it that says image here and lorem ipsum, and how much needs to be real or realistic content. When it comes time for the prototype, we need sufficient content for there to be context of the page. If you show someone a prototype that says logo, nav1, nav2, nav3, nav4, link1, link2, link3, filter1, filter2, filter3, page header here, image, lorem ipsum, and then you ask them to do something on this page, do not be surprised if they fail. They have no sense of context. They don't know where they are, what it means, or what they're supposed to do. And it's the same challenge for clients. You show them a wireframe that is filled with nonsensical placeholder, they don't know where they are. Even if their own site, it's their own product. They just don't have the context. So we need a certain level of fidelity to set the context of the wireframe. There are places where placeholder is okay, there are places where it is not. And you'll really quickly be able to figure that out. In prototype testing, one of the things that you can do to sort of test that sense of place is drop them somewhere into the middle of the site and say, where are you? How do you think you got here? Where can you go from here? Or what can you do from here? And if people can look at that one static image and answer those questions accurately, you have enough information to establish a sense of place. On the other hand, if you drop them in and you ask them those questions and they immediately get the deer in the headlights look, I don't know where I am. I don't know how I could have gotten here. I have no idea what to do from here. It means that either you've got a really crappy design, or more likely, you just don't have enough information for context. They don't have enough there to tell them what's happening, and so they can't make any inferences about that. All right, so, go ahead.
Yeah, what if you have a combination where, okay, you need a user to generate content, or you would like that person to generate the content, but they're also going to need some guidelines as to whether to do it.
Yeah, that's almost always the case.
Right.
So
then what if you have a case where, like in our thing with Feeling Good, is one of the things I had on the map is like, here's a book, here's a two-line description. That would probably fit with just Laura Ipsum, right? But you maybe then put an English description up front that says this is the description.
Yeah,
of the book.
So when I use Laura Ipsum, good point. When I use Laura Ipsum as a placeholder, I almost always put a descriptive sentence or phrase at the beginning of the Laura Ipsum, right? So I'll put in something like, description of the book here, approximately 5 to 7 sentences, Laura Ipsum, blah, 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 to fill out the rest of the space. That way, at least the person who's looking at the wireframe knows what the intent of the paragraph is, but I haven't had to spend 20 minutes thinking about 7 sentences that describes this person's product. They need to be writing that, right? They know how they want to describe their product. I'm supposed to help them figure out the best way to convey that information. I'm not the content strategist, I'm not the copywriter. If you're working in a great situation, there's a visual designer or a creative director, there's an interaction designer, there's a strategist, there's a copywriter, and you're all sort of working as like, you know, conjoined quadruplets or something. You're all working together on this project so that someone's generating the copy under a strategy, someone understands the brand and the brand voice, and you understand the layout of the page. And the group of you comes up with a very powerful design. But as a contractor, as someone who might be the only designer in-house, you might not have all of those services around you, so you're in a situation where you have to use placeholder or you have to write mock text. Any direction that you can give that is going to say, this is what goes here and this is how much I need, is going to help whoever the end copywriter is. Okay, for those of you with print and design backgrounds, how many people in here are familiar with designing with a grid or what grid systems are? Great. So, you've heard of it. If you haven't heard of it, you can raise your hand and pretend you've heard of it and then run home and read about it. So a few, and I was always amazed at this, that the concept of designing to a grid was relatively limited for like the first 10 years of the web. Especially like between 94 and 2000, it was just like, it's on the page. And layout's not an issue, right? It's on the page, people will find it. But the print designers must have just been squirming in their seats when they were looking at web designs because the whole sense of proportion and balance and alignment just wasn't there. And then around 2003 or so, I think is probably like the inflection point in the use of grids on the web, where the whole idea of some structure and layout really sort of hit. And then we labored for like the next 6 or 8 years under this idea of these great layouts. A bunch of people from the print world moved over to the web world, and we saw this evolution in design that took on much more of like the magazine layout feel. And so you look at things, and it just has a much nicer, much more balanced feel to it. The problem is that grids initially, and grids in the print world are a very rigid thing, because you know your page size, right? You know the margins, you know the gutter, you know what the overflow, the
bleed.
Bleed, thank you, yes. You know what the bleed values are in placement? You have really precise control over the exact layout, right? It's like it is going to be this number of millimeters from an edge, and it's going to get placed there. The web, on the other hand, is much more challenging. Different monitor sizes, different browsers, different devices, things end up in different places, alignment shifts a little bit. We don't quite have the control. And now with the whole push toward multi-screen design and responsive design and how are things going to flex as the page changes, suddenly the grid goes from being this wonderful traditional golden mean fee proportionate thing to, oh my God, it all has to slide around and realign itself and float in different ways and still look fantastic, which is a much more difficult design challenge. But there is still an underlying grid, right? We still are thinking about alignment and hierarchy and proportion for things. So in this class, if you want to deal with the responsive issue, you can. It's a big issue for design and development, so I'm not going to expect it of anyone. We're not going to dive deep into the whole topic of responsive design. It's something we'll get closer into in information design too, and in interaction design when we've got multiple screens. This class, I'm okay, grit my teeth a little, I'm okay if we stick with the idea of rigid design, fixed width design, so that we can control things. Because we're learning about the basics of layout and the basics of information design. As long as you recognize that in reality, you're gonna have to design for multiple screens. You're gonna have to design content that looks awesome on a ginormous plasma screen television right down to your smartphone in whatever orientation or whichever tablet form factor you want. So that same content is eventually going to have to be delivered to multiple locations. For this class, we're going to focus on the typical web experience, what you would see like on a laptop or, oh, Dropbox is telling me someone is working. And we'll stick with just sort of standard web. And it'll make it easier for us.
So for the design for multiple screens, that's another class, right?
It's another challenge, it's another topic, yeah. It'll be a different class, yeah. And we don't even have here yet a responsive design class. I'd love to put one together, but I don't even have the time. It would be awesome to teach it though, wouldn't it? It would be a lot of fun.
Better hold on to my wallet.
I've been thinking about, you know, putting something together. Maybe another Saturday class for designing for the responsive web or something like that. Okay, so let's take a look at, we'll take a break in just a moment. There are a lot of references here for website wireframing benefits, design patterns. When we come back, we'll talk about design patterns. But there are several references here for grid-based approaches, grids are good, the grid system. So you can read up on it. One of the first really successful grid systems for the web was the 960 grid system. And now basically the idea of a grid system is that in print you will specify columns and rows, right? Because it's really easy for us to control lockup horizontally. In the web, not so much, because as I change my browser width, things are going to get longer or shorter, and I can't always control that lockup. But in a grid, I can do that. I can say that this column is this wide and things in that column have to be this width. Responsive design mucks it up a bit, but we can still say we have these columns. So almost all of the grid templates that you'll see really are focused on the columns. And so we'll talk about how many columns is your layout. And what's nice about working with columns is let's imagine that this is our web page. And in the 960 grid, you'll see that they start with from 3 to 16 columns. Now that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to have 16 columns of content, you know, like a newspaper. The cool thing about columns is that they're more like layout guides. They're more like a way for us to snap things into alignment. They're not just rigid rivers of content up and down. So let's say that we go with, I'm going to do this as an even number because it's easier for me to draw. We'll say that we've got 8 columns that we're working with here. I know you can't really tell, it looks more like rain. But it's 8 columns. Now, personally, I kind of like an odd number of columns. It's just a, I am drawn toward a certain degree of asymmetry in design, which really irks some people. They are drawn much toward more toward symmetry. I find symmetry to be a little bit more boring, so I like asymmetry, and I'll often break my column boundaries. But the point is, we can say, let's say that there's 8 columns. That doesn't mean I've got 8 columns of text. It means that I've got a way of snapping content to this grid that is going to provide a consistent structure across the pages. And one of our goals in design is consistency. Consistency of the layout, consistency of the interactions, consistency of the voice, consistency of the overall experience. All of that. Because when an experience changes from page to page in little annoying ways, it detracts from the brand, it detracts from the experience, it causes cognitive friction. It makes people slow down and think, why did that move? Why is this different? Why isn't that aligned? Why did it go from here to there? And these are not the questions we want people to be thinking about, right? We want them to think about the content. We want them to think about the message. We don't want them to think about why that button was blue and now it's orange, or why the header was left aligned and now it is centered. That's noise in the experience. And so grids allow us to develop a structure, a system that helps with consistency of layout across the pages. So I can say, in most cases, I have X number of pixels for a header. So I can draw a horizontal line here. Everything between the header and the footer on the web is free-range territory. These pages can shrink and expand based on the content and the functionality that is there. It is really hard to develop a nice horizontal grid system on the web that you're going to be able to adhere to unless you rigidly structure your content. If you can guarantee the height of the page and the amount of the content and the number of images and the functionality, go for it. But it's going to break as soon as you move into responsive design. So relax your need for a horizontal layout in your grid and you'll be much happier. At the bottom then we can say somewhere down here there's a footer and it's probably about that big. So we get a little bit more of that structure again. But I can say things like, I want my logo to span 3 columns. I want my account, my help, and my contact us links across the top here, but I can put one label in each of 3 columns. And so, and then I can say, you know, left align this, and they feel like they're locked up to an underlying pattern, or center it, you know, whatever I choose to do. If I've got content, I can say, you know, that I want these columns to basically be empty space. So I'm not even going to use them. The header has the potential to expand the whole way across. If I have photography, let's say I can break the boundaries and I want my text to flow around the imagery. And the images are 3 columns wide. 2 of them into the gutters and 1 column into the content. But I know that on every page on the site that I'm going to have this distance for margins with the content centered. Or the content may be over here and there are other things that happen. But the point is, I am observing these vertical guides, these columns that are here. And I can choose. I can start with 16, and I can group them and span them or do them individually however I want. I could do 12. I could do 5. You pick the number. You set the grid, but it's based on the content. It's based on the layout. It's based on the brand and how much control you want and how you want to be able to vary or break that. Generally speaking, it's a better idea to go with a larger number of grid columns that are multiples of the number of content columns you want in the design. So let's say that I need a left nav, main content, and a banner ads in the right column, right? I don't want them to be 3 equally sized things, right? If I had three columns in the design and I did it like this, the nav is as big as the content, which is as big as the ads. No. I want the content in the middle, say, to be three times as wide as the stuff on the ends. So I have at least 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 columns here, but I might actually choose to do a 10 column layout, divide each one of these in two, so that I now have some flexibility for breaking the boundaries in the design. Okay? So one of the things that the print people are really comfortable with is the idea of going outside the bounds, knowing when to break the boundaries, when to ignore the edges, because it puts a little tension into the design. It doesn't make everything feel all blocky and locked up and, well, common. So if we split our columns in half, we at least have the opportunity to do things, oops, like, you know, floating an image in the middle and not having the text wrap around it and putting a pull quote here or something like that. But it means that we run maybe from here to do that. We'll put the pull quote on this side. But we get to break the layout in interesting ways, yet still adhere to the underlying grid. So I'm not going to go really, really deep into the grid discussion, but if you haven't familiarized yourself with grids, do read up on it before you start wireframing, and there's lots of examples there. Let's go ahead and take 10 now. We'll start up again at 8:30. When we come back in, we're going to take a look at the new Boston Globe website. I don't know if anyone's seen it yet, but we'll go to that as an example of responsive design. And then we'll do an in-class wireframing exercise to get your hands dirty in sketching. Okay, let's finish our discussion on wireframing, and then we're going to do an in-class exercise for wireframing. Two last things that I want to just do before we get into that discussion. One is talking about design patterns, and one is just showing an example of responsive design. And I'm going to show another site also for grids. I'm sure most of you have seen the new target.com site. Okay, so let's go back and let's talk for a moment about patterns. How many people are familiar with design patterns? You know what patterns are. So anyone who's come from the development background, you know what design patterns or what patterns are, because they're little reusable code snippets, right? It's like, I wrote something to do something, and now I don't have to write it again. I can just go to my library and get that snippet, and I can reuse it. Plug it in, some modification, but I save myself time. Well, once again, the web design world was a little bit slow on the uptake, and so design patterns weren't sort of a concept that was in our vocabulary for the first several years, but then it crept in. And it kind of makes sense, because we found ourselves dealing with the same design problems, the same design challenges over and over and over again. And every time we came across it, we redesigned the solution for it. And then a few particularly bright designers sat up one day and the light bulb went off and they're like, hey, we've done this like 8 times. Shouldn't we write it down so that we remember how we solved it? That way we don't have to think so hard about it again in the future, right? We started to think like attorneys. Write a template document, then charge everyone 3 hours, because that's how long it took to write the original thing, even though I can now fill in the template in 5 minutes, right? So that's what we're doing with design patterns. A design pattern is a solution to a user experience problem that we can use repeatedly. We can apply it in different situations because it's basically the same way to handle it. So great examples of design patterns are things like a login screen, right? We don't have to design it new and improved every single time we have to log in. It's the same 2 pieces of information every time. Your ID, your password. Have you forgotten your password? We can supplement the experience with some nifty little things, like when you put in your user ID, I can go to the server, see if that user ID is in the database. If yes, retrieve the avatar and display it so that when you type in your user ID and you see your avatar pop up, you know you got it right. It's like a little visual confirmation of accuracy. I don't have to do that, but I can make the experience a little bit better by doing that. But the minimum thing is password or ID, password, forgotten password, and then an OK cancel option, right? And then there's a solution for when it doesn't match. How do I display error messages? These are things we do again and again and again. And we develop catalogs of these patterns over time. How does a calendar widget work? How does filtering work on a search results page? How does pagination work? What is a photo gallery, and how do you do next and previous? Right? We don't have to think about these anymore. We have existing libraries of solutions, and we can draw from that. Unfortunately, not all patterns are good patterns. We also often have what are called anti-patterns, and anti-patterns have sort of crept into our repertoires, even though they shouldn't be there. An anti-pattern is a commonly occurring, I don't want to call it a solution, it's a commonly occurring design method that is not an optimal solution.
Say that again?
It's a commonly occurring design, but it is not an optimal solution. It's one of those situations where we do it because that's how it's always been done, but there's actually better ways to do it. And I've pulled up two quick sites here. If you just Google UX anti-pattern, you'll get a bunch of things that pop up. I should add these links to the site. Two that are identified here. One of them is the click here anti-pattern and the shiny object anti-pattern. The click here anti-pattern is basically the idea that you have to tell people where to click. If you have to say, click here to let them know what to do, you have another problem, right? You shouldn't have to say, click here. Where you click should be obvious to the person. If you need to put explicit labeling on, it means it's not obvious, and that's the problem.
Does it, like, adding a call to action help, or?
It might be the language that you use, it might be the location of the link, but it might be the styling of the link. Like, it should be a button instead of a text.
But how does it solve the problem, like, because click here usually happens in like a context, so like a big paragraph, or there's like a, you know, off link to somewhere else.
Right.
And how do you can't put a big old button in the middle of a paragraph.
Right. Solution is I have a personal vendetta against click here. I will redline click here on anything right away.
You just name whatever.
Yes. Give me an active verb. That is the best solution. Download brochure.
Okay, got it.
Right? Not click here to get the brochure. Get the brochure. Download the brochure. Print the brochure. Read the brochure. Tell people what they are going to do. So use the active verb is the easiest solution to the click here anti-pattern. The other one is the shiny object anti-pattern, or the shiny thing anti-pattern. If you find yourself in discussions where people are saying things like, make it bigger, make it brighter, make it flash, make it blink, why don't we do something with a rollover so that they see it? You have a different problem, right? The solution is not always make it bigger, brighter, blinkier. If that's what you have to do to draw attention to something, there's a structural issue with the page or the application. It means that you're putting a call to action in a place where people don't expect it, or it's embedded in too many other calls to action, but just making something bigger, brighter, and blinkier isn't the solution. Right? And it's a little bit different from the whole make the logo bigger joke, but it's still a funny one. So there are some other examples here. The input amnesia anti-pattern. Oh, I hate this one. If people information and then an error occurs, you'd better remember what they typed in, because if you force them to re-enter information, they're gonna leave. Right? That's an anti-pattern. Wipe it. There's one situation, one, where you want to clear that field after an error, right? It's like, if you have personally secure information, like a credit card number or a password, it's okay to ask them to re-enter it after a screen refresh or an error, because it secures their information. But don't blank out the whole form and ask them to put their name and address in again. There's no reason for that. So that's a great example of an anti-pattern that really bothers people. Wrong destination anti-pattern, I'm not going to go through all of these. This is where people are trying to do something, but then you tell them they have to have an account, or they have to log in, or they have to fill out some form first. And so they comply, they do it, and when they're finished, you send them back out somewhere else. You send them to the home page. Yeah. It's like, wait, I wanted to do X, and I complied, I did the form, I completed the survey, and now I'm not back at X anymore. What do? Leave, they abandon. Right? So don't take, at a larger point, the wrong destination anti-pattern means do not take people out of the context of their experience and expect them to find it again. If you take them out of the context of their experience, you'd better be able to put them back in right where they came from. It's like Star Trek and the teleporter, right? You don't want to be off by 6 inches because they're not going to have feet. Or head, or whatever it happens to be. It's like that first gross episode when they materialize in the walls. Or then the first movie, right? When the transporter goes bad and Bones is like, see, I told you, you shouldn't do these things. All right, so those are patterns, anti-patterns. And then the most recent addition is the concept of the dark pattern, right? So a dark pattern is a design that has malicious intent. That's the best way to describe it. This is a design that is intentionally misleading people to perform an action they would not otherwise have chosen to do, right? So that's why I said malicious intent. Given the choice, given the awareness, you would not do this. But the design is crafted in such a way that you don't realize you're being led into making that choice. Like software installers that add a toolbar because you didn't realize when you clicked accept, it was going to reset your search engine and install the widget Orama toolbar in all of your browsers, right? Or my personal pet peeves are kiosks in airports for airlines and for rental cars, right? So you go in and you start off and it's like put in your locator ID number and there's a big yellow button that says continue. And then it asks you, is this your name and destination correct? And a big yellow button that says continue. And then it says, for an extra $100, we'll sell you 5 inches more of leg room. And there's a big yellow button that says, yes, please charge me. And a little tiny gray button off to the other side that says, no thanks, skip this, right? So they get people into this pattern of hit the big yellow button, hit the big yellow button, hit the big yellow button in order to check in quickly. I'm at the airport, I gotta go stand in that security line. And at some point, the kiosk switches over to where big yellow button means charge me more money and give me things that I didn't intend to buy. Right? I would love to know how many irate phone calls United Customer Service gets from people who say, what the is this charge on my credit card? An extra $150 for what? You know, because they don't realize they've done it. Rental car kiosks are the same thing. Is this you? Blah, blah, blah. Yes, continue. Do you want all these extra things? Do you need a child seat? Yes. No, I don't even have children. Right? Why am I pressing this? Because they switch the buttons partway through. That's a dark pattern. Opt in and opt out for newsletters and mailings. That's a real famous one on websites, right? You create the account and the buttons are written in such a way that you don't know. If I check it, am I going to get the newsletter or am I not? Am I checking it to opt out or am I checking it to opt in? I don't know. And so you make a mistake. And so you start getting spammed with newsletters. So those are dark patterns. They are designs that have malicious intent. They mislead people into making choices they otherwise would not have made. So please don't do this. Please be ethical. Anti-patterns are a little bit harder sometimes to detect because we design by habit. We're human. We will do the same thing that we've always done again and again and again. And we don't always stop to think, is there a better way? But the best way to detect an anti-pattern is to ask yourself that question on a regular basis. Is there a better way to do this? to keep your eye competitively on what other sites, other designers, other agencies, other companies are doing. Because someone's going to come up with a better, slicker solution at some point, and we'll see that, and then it'll spread like wildfire, right? It's like everybody did something this way for the longest time, and then all of a sudden there's a sea change. It's like someone flipped the switch, boom, and now we're all doing something differently, right? So years went by before we had the idea of like the contextual hop up in the Lightbox gallery. And then like within 6 months, every website on the out there had a Lightbox photo gallery with next and previous images. It's like, why? Well, because someone asked, is there a better way to do this? And then they wrote the code to do it. And everyone else thought, that's an awesome idea. And it became a new pattern. So there is an evolution. Anti-patterns fade, they get replaced. Design patterns get upgraded. There are old that were perfectly valid design patterns that we no longer use anymore because technology has advanced. And dark patterns emerge because there are people willing to sell their souls. All right, let's take a look at a couple sites here. So just talking about grids, examples here of grids. How many have seen the new Target site?
Yeah, they just redesigned it.
Yeah, so like this one a couple just weeks ago. Launched. This is Ubermind, right? Up in Seattle that did this?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
pretty sure it's Ubermind. Fantastic grid here because it's one of those rare occasions
these custom fonts. Wow.
Pardon? It's one of the great examples of where on certain pages they've been able to pull off the horizontal grid, right? They have really tightly controlled the content to make this work. And one of the drivers behind this, has anyone looked at this on a tablet device?
Not yet.
It looks just like this. And you know what? It's gesture enabled. And if you look at this site, you realize it makes perfect sense. Swipe up, swipe down, the page just scrolls. It works very, very nicely in a touch environment. In fact, if we go, let's see if I get the new Amazon site here on this machine. Amazon's doing the same thing. Oh, crap, Potamus, I got the old one. Nope, they're not going to give it to me. Okay, so some of you might have seen Amazon is like a famous multivariate tester, right? They will run multiple variations of their design. For a site that gets like millions of hits per second, they can afford to do multivariate testing. They will run several variations of their designs for a week or two, collect a couple million visits, and then they'll detect on a very granular level, aha, this one sold $10 more than that one. It's better, and they implement it. And so they're testing a new design. They've got two new layouts, the nice white clean layout. It's pretty sweet, actually. One of them is a more traditional web with navigation, and one is clearly being positioned for a tablet, for cross-device compatibility. And it feels a lot like the Target site.
Now, when you say clearly targeted for tablets, what do you mean by that?
Because they strip out the left column nav, which means they're using the full page width, which means when you rotate a tablet, you always have the maximum width for the content, and it has a very gestural feel to it. They strip away the traditional navigation and make everything feel gestural, which is what you see on the Target site.
Yeah.
It looks a lot like this. But the Target site does have an underlying grid. Look, we get down here and we start to see a little bit of alignment off. Get a little bit twitchy here. Yeah. But they have a core three-column grid. I saw the print people in the room, their eyes went a little bit like, huh? But you can see we've got the multi-column structure here. I'm not sure, is this one responsive? If we change the width, what happens? No. Okay, so it is not. It's fixed width. Okay, but it's nice. Diapers.com is a more traditional layout for the site, but you can see there's a very, very strict grid system that is in operation here. And as we dive in, you know, let's go look for, let's buy diapers. We're on diapers.com, why not? You can see a fairly rigid grid system, very, very traditional grid system here. But then we get into, and Amazon even more so, kind of. If anyone has ever looked at the code underneath Amazon, it's really super kludgy. Amazon is not concerned about like standards and code optimization. Amazon is clearly a sales-driven organization. If you look at how they do things, it's like stuffed with hacks. So it just goes to show that as much as we might be morally opposed to hackishness in design and code, you can still be quite successful from a business perspective without being that strict about it. Okay, so this is the Boston Globe. This is a responsive site. Ethan Marcotte was involved in this. He's the guy that wrote the book Responsive Web Design. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to narrow my browser, for those of you who haven't seen this, to simulate different screen widths. So I'm at 1024 now, which is basically what you would see in an older computer or on a tablet device in portrait mode. In landscape mode. As I narrow it, you can imagine rotating the tablet, and suddenly we get to only 768 width, which is narrower, and then we'll drop down to the smaller, like 7-inch tablet, and then finally drop down to like the iPhone width. And watch very carefully a few things. Watch the scaling of the columns, so as they get wider or narrower. Watch how they reflow the content on the page, where we change the number of columns on the page. Watch the relative placement of things in the header and watch the navigation. So I know that's a lot of stuff to watch, so I'll pause periodically. But as we narrow this, notice the image of the house is getting smaller, the columns are getting narrower. Oop, we hit an inflection point. Layout change, we went from 3 columns to 2 columns. Where'd the ads go? Have no fear, advertising is still there.
Can you scroll?
It's no longer in the right column.
The main nav's gone too.
The main nav changed, yep. Watch, open this up, boom. Yeah. Expose the nav, start to collapse.
Yeah,
start to collapse the nav,
sections.
Right? Search has moved down. Yeah. Narrow in, image gets smaller, columns get narrower, oop, inflection point. Switch to a single column layout. Watch the header. Oh, nav has now jumped up to beside the logo. Logo has gone small. Smaller, 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 smaller. Inflection point. Logo was getting too small, not enough room for the nav beside it. Switched layout. Nav is now underneath, got wider, and the logo got bigger again. Scaled bigger. And now it just gets down to a point. Notice the weather globe over here, or the moon.
Yeah.
It's changing as well. And that's it. We get down to a point where it's just like. Everything is visible in that one column, right? So this is this is the largest scale responsive web design live on the web right now, Boston Globe. But it's a great example of how the grid system changes, and it changes dynamically, but there's always a grid. It was not a free-for-all, right? They had a grid system, they knew exactly how things were going to scale, they knew when they were going to drop from 3 to 2 to 1 based on the width of the page. So they had 3 grid systems that they were using, and then scaling rules in between. And that's all I'll say about responsive design.
If I was an advertiser, I wouldn't be very happy about the fact that the right side of my ads are getting cut.
Yeah, well, the Boston Globe and the designers on the team are not very happy about the ads either, because the ads are not responsive. The ads don't scale. So watch, one of the things that the advertisers are going to get nipped about, watch what happens to the ads. Watch the right edge of the ad. Crop, 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 oop, and then it moves. And then if we go down, we can see the same thing happen again. It reflows, right? And at a certain point, crop, cross, crop, crop. The ads are fixed width. There are no responsive ad servers out there yet. Ads have, it's a legacy of the print world, you bought a space that is this big, and you're gonna get that many pixels. And if they can't be visible, oh well, overflow hidden in that div. Right? It just vanishes. So if the advertising companies want their ads to be more visible and responsive design is on these large sites, they're going to make responsive ads. They add the scale based on the space available. They will have different ad layouts, sizes, and formats based on the module that is available to them. And they will negotiate new placement rules with the sites. So if they're going to do responsive design, the advertisers and the sites are going to have to come to some agreement about how they're going to handle that. Right now, they're not responsive. And the Boston Globe actively made the choice. We will crop your ads in order to maintain the layout of the site. Yeah.
Now, how do you compare this with Target's website? And it, well, Target is another way of being responsive, right? But they choose to have different screen size, I mean, different designs for
A true responsive design is done in the way with media queries, right? So you have multiple CSS files that define rules for different layouts, and the device, the browser and the device, determine which CSS file to apply. So we ask a question, are you greater than 1,000 pixels? If yes, then use web CSS. Are you less than 1,000 pixels but more than 400? Then use tablet CSS. Are you under 400 pixels? Then use mobile CSS. And so all three of those CSS files are available to the browser. The browser picks which one it's going to apply based on what it knows its width is. So that's the media query concept. The old adaptive design way of doing things was pinging, the server would ping the browser and say, what are you and what's your size? The browser would respond, and then the server would send a different set of files based on what the browser said, which is a little bit more like what Target is doing, where Target says, oh, you're a tablet. Here's the tablet site. Responsive design says, here's the site. And the tablet says, oh, I'm this screen width and I'm a tablet, I'm going to use these files.
But what's the philosophy behind that? How did they come to make a decision of either way?
Which one to do?
Yeah.
So. It was probably time, cost, familiarity. Responsive web design is much newer, so it's riskier. There's a greater development effort in that. And it's more difficult. It takes more time to do it and to do it well. Whereas we've got much more history on the old adaptive patterns, you know, where the server pings first and then we deliver what is necessary. So anytime you're in a situation where you're looking at something on a mobile device and you find yourself going to look for the web or desktop version, that's the old approach of the server pinged the browser and said, what are you? And then sent you. So like when you go to Facebook on your phone, it automatically redirects you to m.facebook.com. Even though you might want to go to the desktop version, you have to specifically say, show me the full web version. And Twitter, annoyingly, won't let you do that on most mobile devices. It forces you into the mobile experience, and then it doesn't give you an option to switch to the desktop because it's pinging your device, and it knows you're mobile, and it's only going to deliver those files. A lot of business decisions around it, but timing and cost is a big one. Okay, so in class, we've got just over half an hour. Yeah, you had a quick question?
No, I was going to make a comment real quick. It seemed like just comparing the Target site, though, because they had more control of their content, they could more easily realize a horizontal grid system.
Oh, yeah. The e-commerce site has, the content changes much more slowly than the newspaper site.
Yeah, where here you don't really, like you were saying the other week, where you've got this content manager filling up these templates and you don't have control over it.
Right. But it's still a challenge for e-com sites. Their content still changes on a frequent enough basis. Like Target has daily deals, they've got the weekly circular, they're running special sales, new product launches. Like you probably saw their new site crashed last week with the Missoni, right?
Yeah,
so a new product line was released that everyone was like, but I have it, and they brought the site down. And so, it's a good problem to have in a way, but it brought the site down. So every big site still has content challenges. They're just slightly different challenges. All right, so we're going to do a wireframe exercise in here. We'll spend until about 9:20 or so, and then we can show things. So you can break into groups of three or four, however you want. It doesn't have to be in your project groups. But what I want you to do as a group, and try not to be more than three or four people, because then it's just too much diffusion of ideas. I want you to sketch up concepts for a new home page for the Art and Orchids Bed and Breakfast site, right? So remember, this is the Hawaiian Bed and Breakfast. They've only got 3 rooms. It's kind of a small family-run operation. They're in rural Hawaii on the Big Island. We talked a little bit about who goes there. People have a little bit more sense of adventure, right? They're near, they're 11 miles from an erupting volcano. And so they're artists. The people who own it are artists and gardeners. So we know something about them, about the place. I can surf through the site if you want. Don't go to the live site if you have laptops or anything here, because it's not this site. You'll see a different website, and I don't want that to influence you. So I'll scroll up and down here so that you can see this page. Pretty boring, but you can do whatever you want with the home page here. But the idea is, what's the ideal home page for a bed and breakfast website? How do you communicate the value proposition, right? Like, why is this an awesome place to stay in rural Hawaii? How are you going to make it attractive? Is it a lot of content? Is it a lot of photos? Is it a big splashy 3D flash thing that loads and plays? You know, you get to kind of choose that. But start thinking about, where do you want to put the navigation? Like, is it going to be horizontal or is it going to be vertical on one side? What type of content is going to be there? And you don't have to be really detailed. You can be real sketchy about it, right? Like, I think it might be really nice if the logo were centered and we have a nav bar and there should be a big old photo header and some text. You know, we're just sketching here. We're not doing a high fidelity wireframe. We're just trying to capture ideas for the layout of a home page that is going to communicate, this is the bed and breakfast you're going to stay in. Stop looking at those other websites. This is where you're going to book your reservation, right? We want to get that interest going right from the start. Think about what an underlying grid might be. It doesn't have to be final. Just think about the grid. Think about the navigation. Think about the content and start sketching some ideas. Because your project for next week is to do 3 wireframes for the home page and at least 2 other content pages on your sites. Yeah, this week. The assignment that's due next week.
Okay.
Yeah. So you're going to do a set of wireframes for next week, and we're going to focus on pages that are heavy on content. We're not doing forms or interactive stuff. We're talking about content layout, to really start thinking about a grid and about a navigational system. So you can just, for this site, if you want, I can pull up and show you. We had a proposed site map, so we can put this up. If you're interested in what a proposed navigation was, so you can use this for the nav bar if you want, or you can just repurpose what they already have. But the idea is to sketch up some wireframes, low fidelity wireframes, do multiples in your group, right? So as a group, think about different ways you could sketch the homepage as a low fidelity wireframe for this bed and breakfast site. While you're working on that, I'm gonna do the roll call, so I'll call out your names. 3 or 4 people in a group, mix it up, find someone you haven't worked with before, have some fun with it.